They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights.
On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew.
Joining me on the Common Day, I have Don Dollars, and he's always stirring things up and coming up with some new ideas and new ways of looking at things. Don, thank you so very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So what's the latest? What are you up to now? What have you been doing? I read your stuff, and I thank you for sending me all this stuff because I learned so much. But you're now looking at the insurance companies.
Well, if you recall, I think it was about 18 months ago, maybe 2 years ago, when I was last on. And we in Arizona had formed a very substantial group of people that were working together with legislators to make some very significant changes to the legislation governing homeowners associations. And we had some success, but, you know, one of the problems with homeowners groups is that they are somewhat subject to the whims of the people involved, and everybody has pressures. And so it's very difficult to keep a cohesive group together. So the larger group itself broke down, but not before a number of us still remained intact, trying to do various things. And my contribution to the group, and there's some very talented people in the group other than me, one of whom I always single out, because if you want to read the history of planned communities and municipal development in North America, you should talk to this guy, because he can give you the history of it over 40 years. But my particular contribution, and this is not something that I wanted for myself, but unfortunately the properties that I own and live in have had some serious issues, which if you choose to ignore, then, you know, life can be okay. But if you choose not to ignore, then, you know, you've got some issues to wrestle with. But my particular focus with my financial background has been not so much on wrestling with the issues that you tend to see in the newspapers, such as minor disputes. But my issues tend to go to the heart of the issue, which I think is money.
Yes, I agree with
and
you.
My theme still remains, and the evidence continues to accumulate, that, you know, we have over 60 million people living in homeowners associations in this country. A substantial number of them are living in Arizona because it's a fast-growing state. And the money pool within that group of people, we estimated at somewhere between $50 and $60 billion, is still a hot pot of total flagrant violation of some pretty basic banking rules, which get into the Patriot Act and money laundering procedures and things that relate to money movement. And the end result is us to remain convinced that within the pool of homeowners that are part of that 60 million, particularly when you've got some big management companies like First Service, who I consider to I consider them to be Enron on steroids, we still have a vast pool of wrongdoing that's going on, simply because nobody's looking, and the regulators in question, they're not looking, they're never looking forward, they're looking backwards. So that's the backcloth. And so I've been looking at, where does the money come from to fund all these activities and motivate HOAs and management companies to do what they do. And apart from the banks, who there's five or six of them that are concentrating on this, and I'm sure doing very, very well out of it, the second source of funding for what I call nefarious activities are the insurers, who are insuring homeowners associations, and who often are the source of large amounts of money to defend cases that are brought by homeowners. And some of the unscrupulous attorneys have no compunction in calling down the defense claims and the policies provided by those insurance companies, and providing a large source of money to those attorneys to engage in padding their own pockets and prolonging disputes and doing anything but to resolve them.
So why is that? Why is that, John?
Well, the group we have in Arizona is reasonably well connected to other groups in other states. So we're not completely ignorant of what's going on in other states, like California, particularly in some of the states on the East Coast. But there are some not unique aspects of Arizona, but there's some different ones that don't always apply to other states. So, for instance, one of the sources of money for, and the attorneys are the people that are largely to blame for this, because they're the ones that are the big beneficiaries from running up legal costs. And I want to get to the insurers in a minute, but just to set the stage with money generally, Arizona is one of, I think, what's called 15, one of 15, I believe, what's called super lien states in the United States. And those are states that, and this again gets back to the history of how the housing and finance industry was put together a number of years ago. But a super lien state is one where the HOA association fees that can be levied against a homeowner, and they can be, we can be talking very small amounts of money in this case, the original assessments plus legal fees. Once they get to $1,200, you can foreclose on a property owner's house, and you can do that to the detriment of the bank, which shocks most people. The idea that, you know, a bank providing maybe 75-80% of the purchase cost of a home could find its mortgage ranking secondary to a lien from a homeowners association, which might start off as $50. But that is the case, and there's a case in Nevada which looks like it's heading from the Ninth Circuit on this very point to the U.S. Supreme Court, with Mr. Kavanaugh, of course, now, simply because the banking industry is not prepared to see its security disappear in the face of homeowners' liens. And that provokes foreclosures, because if you can foreclose on a homeowner's house, there's a great incentive for the attorneys to run up fees, because that's how you're going to get paid.
You know, I'm going to interrupt you here for just a minute, because when Virginia enacted legislation allowing HOAs to foreclose non-judicially, I contacted the banks and said, you better help me fight this, because you're going to be stuck holding the baby. And you know what they did? They just shrugged their shoulders. They didn't care.
Well, they're not shrugging their shoulders now, because J.P. Morgan was on the receiving end of one of these, I think, back in 2007. And I've read the details, and I've probably forgotten most of them, but I know the bones of it. Not only was their mortgage on the property in Nevada prove to be secondary, it was extinguished.
Yeah.
It disappeared.
Yeah.
And so that's been going backwards and forwards in the Nevada courts, and I've lost track exactly of where it is, but most professional experts seem to feel it is going to end up in the Supreme Court. And the numbers that have been bandied around as to legal expenses on that case, because it could undermine the whole U.S. housing industry. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars purportedly of legal expenses being spent. So that's going to somehow surface. But to get back to what I think was the original topic of the conversation, which was the insurance, the other thing that's unique about Arizona a little bit is that we have, and this really gets into a big subject around the First Amendment and the right to petition, which is one of the oldest of fundamental rights under the Constitution. The legislators in Arizona said, a number of years back, look, we have a problem with homeowners associations. And we've got thousands and thousands of cases that are making their way into the courts, and $50 garbage can disputes are turning into federal cases. What do we do about it? Well, they decided to put in place a process which uses the executive branch, not the judicial branch. And in the case of Arizona, that role now falls to the Arizona Department of Real Estate. They act as, if you like, a quasi-regulator, but with very few powers. It's more of a moral suasion at the end of the day. And homeowners can petition the Department of Real Estate. And the word petition is very important, because that's the word petition, as in the rights petition, mm-hmm. which is the oldest part, the oldest rights under the First Amendment. So basically, you have the right to go with a process to your government and argue your case. And in the case of Arizona, rather than the executive branch officials themselves dealing with it, we have an office called the Office of Administrative Hearings, which regulates everything that government does, dentists, not doctors, but contractors. And they sort of subcontract the adjudication of a dispute. And so in our case in Arizona, we file a petition with the Department of Real Estate, and then it gets heard before the Office of Administrative Hearings, and you get a judgment. The what the law firms here in Arizona have been quite successful doing is playing on people's fears and the bogeyman, and they love describing the process that I've just described as litigation.
Yeah.
And I could give you 9 reasons why it isn't litigation, one of which is the separation of powers and the First Amendment. The second is this judicial process doesn't have any real teeth. You can't enforce anything. And it's more a form of moral suasion, but they have been able to persuade the insurers that when this case, which is meant to be in the homeowner files a petition for $500, and it's meant to be a simple process, takes a couple of hours at most in most cases, they turn that into full-fledged litigation. And by the way, in Arizona, there is a number of appeals court rulings which define an administrative process as not being litigation. It is specifically designated as if you petition your government, and it could be against a contractor, it could be against any number of people, that is not an action. That is not litigation. It's not a court. There's no damages. There's no attorney's fees awarded. And that's the thing that they hate, because this process doesn't have any ability to award attorney's fees. Uh-huh. A number of insurers have Liberty Mutual was the insurer for the homeowners association I was living in until recently. And we had a minor dispute, which actually was going at books and records related to bank accounts, and eventually proved that the case itself proved for $500 that FDIC insurance didn't apply to the banking structures. But the real point was Liberty ended up paying $28,000 of legal expenses to defend a case that was a minor case, and they funded the attorneys to that extent. Now, I'm personally trying to sell my property in this particular subdivision, so my interests are very narrow. I'm not engaged in so much community service here, as I've got a problem, which is I want to sell my property, and I've got a disclosure issue. And so I filed a petition there, and it transpires that a new insurer has now stepped into the breach, which is Philadelphia Insurance, owned by a big Japanese group. And it would appear that this insurer has stepped in where Liberty stepped away, and is what I consider to be the current victim, if you like, because I think of it in those terms, of a system whereby the attorneys can go to the insurers and persuade them to fund all kinds of things which frustrate the objective of the legislators, because the objective of the legislators in setting up this informal dispute resolution process was not to give attorneys a mechanism to turn it into a federal case and run up lots of legal fees. But they've done that. And so my approach here has been, follow the money. In this case, it's going after the insurers who I believe are on the receiving end of some misrepresentation as to what they're actually involved with. The way the insurer is doing this is that they're allowing themselves to accept a claim which is presented to them as litigation when in fact it's not, because it's an administrative process, and therefore the policy kicks in, and so these attorneys have access to a meal ticket to prolong this process, make it as inflated as possible. And in the case of Arizona, this process, we know from insurance professionals and from other respectable attorneys, the average cost of defense of one of these cases when it's supposed to be a simple procedure is running at about $30,000 per Office of Administrative Hearing case, which is very close to the $28,000 I know came about because of the case I filed a year ago. And again, you've got to bear in mind that this is a mechanism the legislators put in place to say, file a petition, pay you $500, turn up, sit in front of an administrative law judge who has no powers of enforcement anyway, by the way, and we'll give you a decision. And if the HOA doesn't abide by that decision, then you really don't have many alternatives but to go and take that to Superior Court. But it's a form of moral suasion, because most homeowners associations and even their attorneys would admit that if you got a judgment against you, even though it's an administrative ruling, you better take note of it. But that is being frustrated by the actions of these attorneys in, I believe, misleading the insurers. I think some of them are waking up to the fact that this is not good business, because the insurers, amongst other things, are defending cases where there's no award of attorney's fees. So that from the insurer's perspective, if they were to defend a traditional lawsuit and they won, they would get a recovery of their damages from the lawsuit. But in this case, it's a total write-off for the insurer. There is no ability to recover attorney's fees, and it's designed that way. So it's a bit of a loss leader for the insurance companies, and the question I have is, how long are these insurers going to allow this to happen? In the current case, Liberty having withdrawn a year ago and now Philadelphia Insurance stepping in, the rather unusual twist to that, and this gets into cultural things and how corporations do business in various countries, Philadelphia Insurance happens to be owned by Tokio Marine, which is a Japanese company, and I believe the largest insurance company in Japan. And this company advertises itself as wanting to be a good company. And it has some very persuasive stuff on its website, and Japanese companies do behave differently. I have personal experience of that. I've been saying to them, I do not believe you're acting as a good company. You may be legally observing the terms of the policy that you have, but you are doing business in the state of Arizona, and you are acting contrary to government policy, and that's not good business. So they've been subpoenaed as part of this process to come up with some records, and I don't quite know where they're going to come out in this. So all the indications so far are that they're acting professionally, and we'll see what they come out with. But obviously, my goal with them is to see if we can somehow turn off the cash spigot, which is turning a very, very minor dispute. And it's really about some chicken wire blocking some drainage easements. You know, get this thing resolved rather than turning it into a meal ticket for the attorneys.
Are they not aware of what's going on? I mean, how can they not know that they've been reeled in, lied to, and they're funding all this stuff that they're not supposed to be funding?
Well, I think there's two reasons for that. One is insurance companies. And there's a very good report out recently which talks about how the social compact between all the insurers in this country, all the big names and the customers have broken down. And so the insurance companies, many of whom are still mutual companies, they're no longer partners with their customers. They're adversaries, and their goal is to increase stock market value. So that's one element. The other element is that I have a hard time believing that the chairman of Tokio Marine, sitting in Tokyo, and he's been on the receiving end of some of this, has a clue about what the underwriting and the insurance brokers might be enticing his company somewhere in the United States to be doing, which I believe, runs contrary to policy. And therefore, the real question is, once they become aware of this, what do they do about it? Because these corporations are big corporations, and I've got enough experience of dealing with the Fortune 500 to know that they're not all bad actors. Some of them are actually very, very good actors. But even the good actors get involved sometimes in things that they didn't intend, they didn't plan. And then the real question is, what do they do about it? That they walk towards the problem and fix it, as potentially Liberty did. I have some evidence that suggests that Liberty looked at this and said, we just don't think that the business of insuring D&Os for homeowners and homeowners associations is good business. So let's pull out of it.
Good for them. Kudos to them for having done that. As I told you before we went on the air, I have talked to some of these insurance companies. They hire attorneys who really don't know what they're doing, but their goal is to beat up the homeowner because they don't want homeowners asserting their rights.
Well, and that gets back to the fundamental issue here, which is I don't believe that all the people working for management companies are bad people.
No, I agree.
Not a single management company is regulated. Not a single. I mean, nothing about the homeowners association industry is regulated. The only people that are regulated that are on the fringes of the homeowners association industry are the banks and the insurers. And we know that the banks are not complying with the Patriot Act. I know that. But there are things afoot and pressure points that you can put on them. But the management companies, you have actually no leverage at all. So the question is, there's a lot of good people, well-motivated people work for these management companies. Why do we have this problem? The answer is money. There are enough people in the industry pulling the levers of power to realize that $50 to $75 billion of money sloshing around in homeowners associations is a very attractive source of financing. And if nobody's looking at it, then let's make hay while the sun shines. And that same principle applies to the insurance, because anytime you've got a source of money coming into the HOA pool that the attorneys can use to, you know, pay themselves, they will take it. So the insurance industry and the banking industry are, in effect, complicit, knowingly or unknowingly, in this, and they're funding these activities. And if you can take the money away, I think a lot of these problems will go away. I don't want to get too complicated in this, Shu, but you and I talked very briefly about something that links insurance to banks, and it was the concept that maybe the insurance policy that each D&O insurer or each board has is not actually one policy, but it's part of a pool.
Right.
I don't have any direct evidence to support that. But my gut feel tells me that that's exactly what's happening, particularly with some of the insurance brokers. And these are not the insurance companies, but the insurance brokers that have very strong links to CAI. I mean, there's a number of, don't forget, an insurer who's insuring the risk can only rely on what they're told by the brokers. And so they could be getting told a bill of goods. And in fact, in the documents I uncovered, the application for new insurance for this association, my insurance, this current one, there were some gaping holes in the disclosure that was made by the management company, which, by the way, was the entity that filled out the application for insurance. But the real point is there's a money source here, and it's being milked. And the real point I was getting to was, and this is going to sound terribly bankerly, but you know, people who might be listening can go and Google this and they might surprise themselves by what they find. There is a principle which gets back to whenever you pool things, management companies pooling monies, insurance companies pooling insurance, the principle, and it only gets uncovered in bankruptcy, is what's called substantive consolidation in bankruptcy. And it's the argument that if you've got management companies with all these different HOAs and you've got insurers and you've got banks, if they are not conducting business on a truly arm's length basis, if something ever happened to one of those players, a management company getting into bankruptcy, for instance, which, you know, I look at the financial statements for First Service, which controls somewhere between 15 and 20% of all the HOAs in this country, a bankruptcy judge might say, this is all one big pool. You're all in it together.
Right.
And that is a really, really, really scary thought. Because the worst case scenario, if you pursue that line of reasoning, is that you've got pooled banking arrangements. You've got pooled banking arrangements, which mean that your monies aren't really FDIC insured, and I think we've proven that. You've got pooled banking arrangements whereby there's no regulation of the people feeding money transfers into the ACH system. And then you've also got management companies that don't have any real assets. They can disappear overnight. If anything happened to one of these management companies, people walk out the door, how does the association pay its landscaping bill the following day?
You know, can we break this down? You've been using a lot of big words here, but can we break it down so that the average listener understands exactly what we're talking about? And when you pool things, you're talking about the management company managing a number of different associations, buying insurance coverage and buying different things in their name, but then charging each one of the associations they manage the entire premium. Presumably they pocket the rest of it. So just for the heck of it, say you've got $1 million.
If you also have at the same time one bank account where the only documentation for maybe 200 HOAs is a bunch of signatories that are all management company employees, and the names of the directors of the HOA don't appear on the underlying documentation. And then, by the way, the management companies take all the decisions because the board does exactly as they're telling them. Then, I don't want to get technical, but the arm's length relationship between the management companies and this corporation, which happens to be a non-profit, which is the HOA, breaks down.
Yeah.
And I don't have any, I mean, I've been through substantive consolidation with some major corporations, even major corporations, I'm not going to mention some names, but they are household names, either went into bankruptcy because of this, or in one case escaped it because the mess was so great from this substantive consolidation argument that they managed, the bankers were so scared they didn't put it into bankruptcy. But we'll only find out when the proverbial hits the fan. But I've been of this opinion for a number of years that your typical HOA is not a corporation with a management contract with a management company. It's actually much closer to a partnership where the general partner is the management company. And once you reach that conclusion, then it becomes very, very scary. The worst case would be that, as I say, one of these management companies would disappear. And if the management company disappeared one day and you don't have the powers to sign on your bank account, I can tell you exactly what's going to happen, because it happened in one case. The HOA will go down to the bank, and the bank's going to say, who the hell are you?
Yeah, yeah. Is this legal, John? Is this legal? I mean, I can't imagine this being legal.
Well, it depends on that, you know, if it's legal, what you're probably talking about is the possibility for fraud. Well, that's a very complex analysis. We do know that fraud's going on because we read about it in the papers all the time. But is this structure fraudulent? At certain levels, yes, because you know, when you get an example, I had of an HOA. We had one of the HOAs I own property in. This is now a good story, but it wasn't. We had to put it into the hands of a receiver. It sounds awful, but actually the receiver is regulated by the judge. And if every HOA was run the way that this association's run, we wouldn't have any problems because it's been professionally managed.
Finally, huh?
And it was a case of victory being snatched from the jaws of defeat. It's an amazing example of how things could run if something was regulated. But in the meantime, there was no question that the management company and the prior attorneys were sucking money out and writing checks to themselves, and that gets into what's called fraudulent conveyance, which again is a technical term, but if you catch somebody doing that, conveying somebody else's assets to themselves for their own benefit, when they know that taking that money out of the association's bank account could create problems, then yes, that's fraudulent conveyance. The problem is, Shu, is that I guess I just happened to be a guy who had lots of corporate banking experience with lots of complex transactions, and I never thought that I'd have these issues to look at in the context of an HOA. But if we were looking at a major corporate structure, all the issues I'm talking about, the bankers would sit in a room and they'd go, oh, my God. But the problem is nobody's looking at this.
Nobody's looking at it. But nobody believes it. Oh, you're just smoking funny cigarettes. This can't be happening.
Well, and I've had some of that myself, which is that people, you know, I like to think I rely on facts, and not everybody in the homeowners associations I've lived in is a fan of me. But I think most people, certainly municipal governments I work with, understand I don't say things without the basis in fact. But, you know, even people that are inclined to believe me, I've had them say to me, John, you know, I listen to what you're saying, right, and it just sounds a little bit far-fetched.
Yeah.
Until they get into it themselves. And I had one instance where somebody came back and said, John, you know, I want to apologize. You know, we always trusted you, but you know, some of the things that you were saying just didn't sound right. But now I know you were right. And so yeah. The real question is, you know, who's prepared to listen?
So
what is it going to take to fix this? I try as you might, and there's a lot of very powerful forces at work. I wish the legislators would get involved and legislate and regulate this whole industry and take a backwater. I mean, it's hard to describe 60 million people, which is 20% of the U.S. housing market, living in a backwater. But you've got a corner of the U.S. housing market, which has defects anyway, which is rife for a problem. And I fear that what it's going to take is a problem of the similar type we had with the First Reserve breaking the buck in 2008, and or maybe a class action suit, because, you know, there's plenty of evidence building that some of the biggest losers in this are minority groups who typically are female. I mean, we even try to get Me Too involved in this, but they seem distracted by other stuff. But a class action suit, I think, could be the trigger. But if it's a crisis, it'll be a case of the regulators looking at it and saying, well, why didn't we see this? And the answer was, you weren't listening again.
Okay, but you know what? I'm going to say something that's extremely controversial now. I think in the 30 years that I've been doing this and paying attention and learning about HOAs, I have noticed that every time there's legislation that's been enacted, it's enabling legislation, empowering associations. When we manage to get something good that actually protects the homeowner, they come back, CAI comes back, lobbies hard, we're here representing the homeowners, and the homeowners don't want this, so change it. Here's a prime example. Now, why any legislator believes this, why they went with it, is beyond me. But something as simple as this. If you buy a house, you've got a disclosure package. The association is responsible for giving you all the information about the association. One of the pieces of information in Virginia that you're required to get is whether or not that particular house has a covenant violation listed. And if they say no, then there was a time when you could take that to the bank, that there was nothing there. Because typically what was happening is people are buying were buying houses because they fell in love with something, and as soon as they moved in, the HOA came by and said, "Oh no, 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 you cannot have that because there's no approval on it. You've got to take it down." So we fixed that. Now the industry has come and taken that away. You can no longer rely on that. So you get your disclosure package. It says there are no violations. But you cannot rely on that in the least.
Well, but in Arizona, for instance, they've taken a stage further, and this was the step forward, but it can be a step backwards. The disclosure obligations by the HOA, it depends on the size of the HOA, but if you're above 50 homeowners, the HOA has to disclose at escrow closing, but it only arrives at escrow closing through the title company, the existence of any litigation. Well, this is how about this? The association in my case and the attorneys have been arguing vehemently that we are now engaged in litigation. This Office of Administrative Hearing Procedure is in effect a federal court case. The bogeyman's out there where,
yeah,
you know, you need us to defend you. And yet when they come to make the declaration on their insurance policy for the renewal of their insurance, the question is, has there been any litigation? And the answer is no.
See, I don't think that all of this legislation is helping. In fact, if anything, it's making things worse. I had Senator Mike Schneider on from Nevada, and I asked him point blank. I said, "Mike, why don't you deregulate associations?" And you could hear him suck the air out of the rooms. Oh my gosh, you can't do that. Why not? I'm in favor of deregulating everything so they don't have.
Well, you are into, as one of our team who I really, you ought to interview him at some point. I'll prompt you to the fact that he might get a call. He truly can give you the whole history of how, you know, the FHA regulations, HUD, 40 years of how the paperwork for mortgages, for instance, somehow had in it the requirement that you have to have a management company to get in, to get a HUD-approved loan. There's a lot of history and inertia. You can't rebuild the U.S. housing system. And the sad reality is that for better or worse, all the people that live in homeowners association are living in a structure where they are contractually bound to their neighbors and to the association. And the minute you say that, and you believe in the sanctity of real estate and personal contracts, there is automatically a limit on how legislators can interfere with those rights of private contracts. So, for instance, I've made this argument and not got very far with it. The administrative law process that we have in Arizona, which really does work, it allows you to do two things. And these are only disputes between homeowners and associations, not between members themselves. Or there's no damages or anything of that type. You can only take to them disputes of two types. One is where the association has essentially gone against a statute, which is dealing with books and records primarily and transparency issues. But the process also allows the hearing to listen to disputes as to the CCNRs. Once you do that, and I've argued that maybe we'd be better off just restricting it to the books and records, you're opening up a Pandora's box where the legislators are to some extent
interfering,
regulating private contracts.
Yeah, they are.
And that we might be much better off if the legislators had said, look, kind of nice to look like we're putting a Band-Aid on something here and we've got a CCNR dispute resolution process, but maybe if we took care of the transparency and said, let's have a complete focus on transparency, then the democratic process could work. But most of the efforts of what I see going on with the industry is, you know, literally, if you're a little old lady, the proverbial little old lady, and I've got plenty of examples of these. If you don't have much to do and decide to go to your HOA meeting one day and ask for books and records to inform yourself, you can get an injunction.
One of my favorite stories of all time is the Ferran case from right here in Virginia. They bankrupted their HOA. Well, they didn't do it. The HOA did it. They kept suing them, and the Ferrans won. And in Virginia, you know, the prevailing party is entitled to fees and costs. And so they were awarded every penny they asked for, so the association decided to go back again, and they sued them on something else. I mean, it just went on and on and on to the point where the HOA was bankrupt. The Ferrans tried to extinguish the association, but that was going to be too difficult. What they did was they amended the governing documents and they stripped the HOA of all the powers. They don't have the power to do anything. The covenants are gone, the rules are gone, everything is gone. And it went from being a war zone to being a community where the members get together and they work problems out.
And there's been some moves in this state to do that from the get-go, which is to in effect allow developers to create subdivisions, but the role of the association is not to regulate garbage cans. If it has any role at all, it's merely to act as a billing mechanism for common pieces of infrastructure.
And that's the reason you have HOAs.
Well, I mean, you do, but in the case of my subdivision, two subdivisions, there's no infrastructure. There's nothing really to build. You know, there is a limited amount of infrastructure, but 90% of the issues relate to what I would call good neighborhood issues, where you've got these covenants and restrictions imposed on people that never wanted them in the first place. So once you take away the color of the garbage can, which has got nothing to do with infrastructure, you take away a lot of the source of the dispute. So I think the approach they came up with there is an interesting end result. But we tried as part of our legislative actions 2 years ago to say, why don't you give the developer? Well, look, if you talk to people in Arizona, once you get beyond Supreme Court decisions and you know, partisan politics, the thing that people are most likely to say is, I don't want to live in a homeowners association.
They do.
And yet, you don't have the, if you want to buy an affordable home, meaning less than $750,000, I can't find anywhere in Arizona that you can go and buy a home of that type where you're not obliged to sign some CC&Rs. So we try to change that. And our argument was, why don't you give the developer the choice? Give the customer the choice. I can live in a subdivision where there's CC&Rs, so I don't have to worry about my neighbor painting his house yellow. Or I don't have any CC&Rs. And it just didn't work. The forces in the real estate industry just didn't want to hear about, in effect, giving the consumer more choice.
It's the reason we have these mass-produced HOAs is to give local municipal governments free tax dollars. That's it. That's how it started.
Absolutely.
That's how it started. That's why it's being force-fed on us. You can have covenants. In fact, covenants go back to England. You don't have to have an HOA to oversee the covenants.
That's right.
You know, if you and I live next door, it's budget shifting.
Yeah.
If you and I lived next door to each other or across the street from each other and there was a covenant on our houses that said you couldn't do this, that, or the other, if you did it and it didn't bother me, I mean, it probably wouldn't bother me and I'd just shrug it off and live with it. But if I didn't like it, I could use my money and take you to court and say, Your Honor, here's the covenant, here's a picture of John's house, make him take it down. And that's all you need. You don't need.
Except who wants to get, the thing is trying to avoid a mechanism where you're forced into a court situation because that's a bit of a zero-sum game. But
Yeah, but I mean...
Yeah, so silly example, in the case of the new house I'm in now, the restrictions on vegetation that I can put in my backyard don't come from the CCNRs. They come from the local municipality.
Which is ridiculous.
Well, I'd rather have the municipality regulating it than the HOA, frankly, because I'd get a better response if I go down to see the mayor.
Why would the mayor care what you've got in your yard, John?
Well, because if they've passed an ordinance in the town I live at the moment, they do care about stuff like that, the visual look of the community. If somebody was to infringe that ordinance, then they would probably move to do something about it. And although, I don't mind having rules in which I live, as long as I read them first and then I decide whether I want to live in that community. If I'm going to have rules, the most important thing once you've got that, and this is the issue I've got now, is if you have rules, you've got to consistently apply them. You don't kind of have them, and there are restrictions for some people, but they never get enforced. If you're going to have rules, make them consistent and apply them consistently. And I would rather trust my local governments, if there was a covenant that I didn't mind, to enforce it than the HOA. Because at the moment, my issue right now that I'm dealing with, that's the subject of some of the stuff you've been seeing, is not the broad picture of money laundering. It's a very narrow issue. I want to sell my house, but I have a disclosure issue because there's a covenant requiring the homeowners association to make sure that drainage easements are kept clear, and they won't enforce it. So I have either a disclosure issue to tell people that my house is at risk of flooding, or I go fix it, one of the two. And of course, I took the decision to try and fix the problem, so I won't have a disclosure issue. But it is a very simple issue of, you put these rules in place, half the people like them, the other half don't even read them. But if you don't apply them consistently, that's a recipe for disaster. And if you don't apply them consistently from the beginning of a subdivision, then you're stoking up the problems that you just alluded to, which is somebody buys later and they fall out of favor with the HOA, and they've got a problem with something they didn't do. But Shu, one of the things my feeling is, and I can't prove this, is that the insurance industry is waking up to this. There's lots of anecdotal evidence, to get back to insurance, that a number of the insurers are either pulling out or tightening up. So my information suggests very strongly, despite what the management company said to blame it on me, that Liberty pulled out for, broader industry reasons. I do know, and I'm not one of these people that thinks that everything that CAI does is automatically bad, there is a move afoot to, I'm not going to mention the name because I've had some experience with them, and I'm not 100% sure they're doing it for the right reasons, but there is one well-known broker who's operating a program under the sponsorship of CAI, which looks like what it's doing is putting in a very, very much stricter vetting procedure as to the behavior of an HOA, particularly with regards to the D&O insurance, that in some ways is a better way of doing it. Instead of pulling out completely, somebody's saying, look, if we're going to give D&O insurance, let's do it properly. Let's have the application for the insurance to be thorough. Let's have the proper declarations made. But I suspect there's other insurers that are just, just walking away.
Well, as I told you before we went on the air, in the old days when all this didn't get quite so big and so complicated, if you had an abusive board member, all the homeowners had to do was reach out to the insurance company and say, look, this board member, whether it's the president or whoever it happened to be, is acting outside the scope of their authority. They are doing things that are not part of what they're supposed to be doing. You could be facing litigation that you will have to cover. So in the old days, the insurance company came in and checked things out and said, look, you either get rid of that board member or we cancel your policy. I don't know that happens so much anymore.
I don't either, but it may be happening here because in my particular situation, we now have, and this homeowners association I'm dealing with is a small one. It's only 49 homes. They have $110,000, $120,000 in the bank, which at least is now FDIC insured, whereas it wasn't previously. But there are three petitions, one passed, one current, and another one that I was obliged to file a week ago. And if you follow the rules of the maths, $28,000 per case, they're looking at $86,000 of insurance claims for an association that has not much more than that in the bank.
Wow.
And the reason that's happened is because, for whatever reason, the board doesn't want to take note of what's being said and doesn't want to be the party that goes down and sits in front of an administrative law judge and resolve matters themselves. They fell for the argument that said, don't worry, it's all going to get covered by the insurer.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what they're always told. Oh, don't worry about a thing. We'll just get it from the homeowner. Insurance company will cover it. And so they go.
Well, they did last time, but the end result was the insurer pulled out and the deductible went to $15,000 and the premiums went up.
Yeah.
So there's no, because again, in this situation, the insurer doesn't have a way of offsetting its losses by claiming legal fees at the end of a dispute. There are no attorney's fees. And it's consistent with the separation of powers. If you go and petition your government to help you, and you have a choice to do that or go to the judicial process, why on earth could you ever be hit with legal fees for asking your government's officials to help you out? It's not the way the Constitution is written. So the insurers have no means. The only means they have of turning insuring D&O claims or covering D&O claims for this administrative process is by getting it back later, either pulling out or jacking the premiums up, which means the homeowners are paying ultimately.
Yeah, the homeowners are stuck with it. With all this evidence, John, why is it that so many people just ignore all of this stuff? Why do we keep having the same problems and hear the same stories over and over again?
Well, I look at that. There's a lot of different elements to that, parts of which you could sort of attribute to some of the stuff we saw with the Supreme Court nomination, but let's not go there.
Okay.
If I keep it to keep away from sociological issues and look at it purely as a segment of the housing market that's got $75 billion, maybe $50 to $75 billion sloshing around. It's a big source of revenue. That's a big honeypot for people, attorneys, and management companies to get their hands on. It fundamentally comes down to money. And I'm afraid I'm a bit long in the tooth with crises on Wall Street, and some of which we were able to predict and get out before anybody else knew. But I've seen many, many crises, whether it's countries getting into trouble, companies getting into trouble, Enron, the real estate crisis, long-term capital management, Asian countries, where the signs are all there. They're all there, and yet nobody does anything about it.
Yeah, we've been watching that for years, which is, it's coming.
Well, the fundamental reason is the problem with the financing industry is that, and I brought a whistleblower case in London around the money laundering issue, which taught me a very valuable lesson because I lost it. I won the moral battle, but I lost the case because I realized that it is immensely difficult to persuade the ordinary person in the street of the rights and wrongs of financial machinations. Finance is something that most people don't want to admit they don't understand, so they nod. But at the end of the day, the only people that really understand these financial issues are the people that are on the inside.
Yeah.
And so the public at large glazes over, decides it would be embarrassing to ask embarrassing questions when there's no such thing as embarrassing questions, just embarrassing answers. And the regulators are always looking in the rearview mirror.
That's true. John, thank you so much. Believe it or not, we are out of time. I learned so much from you when you come, and I'd like to learn more about financing. I don't promise to understand it, but I do promise to listen.
Okay, and I would love to hear any feedback through you from people listening to this as to what they perceive the insurance companies are actually doing, because at the end of the day, we can't have insurance. We can't have homeowners associations without insurance. We've just got to do it in the right way. So I'm not trying to break the system here. I'm trying to make sure it works. Except in this very narrow case, for once, I've got a very narrow interest, which is I want to sell my house without a disclosure problem.
Good luck with selling your house, and John, thanks again.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.